Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust in 2002 and goes out every Thursday morning at 11am here on BCFM 93.2. This week, we chat with our internet security person, Ed Lander, and also Bristol activist Paul Saville, as well as our news review and private eye review with Jason Yannakopoulos. Dialect is produced by volunteers. If you want to join in, contact Volunteering Bristol, whose office is just off Queen's Square. You can call them on 0117 989 7733, or you'll find them on the web at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. And I'll repeat those contact details at the end of the show. But we start off with Ed Lander. Now, Ed, I jokingly called you the our security internet security correspondent, but what are your qualifications for knowing about the internet? How did you first get to, you know, get online and get to know how to use it?
That's a very good question. I grew up as the internet became commonplace, so I was on that threshold. I wasn't born and it was there. I guess I got to know it at a fairly early age, and I was tinkering with computers in my early teens, sort of taking them apart and updating them. And I just always had this interest in technology and just learnt with the internet as it evolved.
I mean, did you ever have a sense of it being the web, almost like something sticky that you get attached to and you try and get away from, but you can't? I mean, I always try and consciously on this show read out alternative ways of getting hold of information and don't assume that people have got access to the net.
I guess I try and think that, you know, there are other ways to get access to key information, but these days it just seems so convenient and so easy that I fall into that trap of not really catering for those without the internet, I've got to be honest.
Well, because, I mean, with the Edward Snowden revelations from June all the way through until now, June last year, 2013, it seems that there are actually a kind of, you're giving up a lot of your privacy. Almost any information you give on the internet is likely to be stored and may be used against you, possibly in future.
That's something that more and more people are realizing each day. As I was growing up with the internet, it didn't seem a dangerous tool. You know, broadly, it seemed like entertainment. I believe the French authorities were pushing a few years ago for social media corporations to have a sort of delete kill switch if you decided that the internet became too sticky and there were things out there that you didn't like, or maybe even information that was false, that was discrediting you, that you could just pull the plug and all that information would go. But I honestly don't think there's been any traction in that whatsoever. It's what's up there tends to stay, and I think it's particularly difficult to even get rid of libelous information these days.
Well, Glenn Greenwald has been the journalist based in Brazil, freelance, that's been attached to The Guardian, New York Times, doing a lot of the actual number crunching through the Edward Snowden revelations to turn them into, you know, easily digestible stories over the last 6-8 months. He's now parted company directly with The Guardian, and he's doing individual deals with all sorts of websites, other newspapers, etc. One of those articles is entitled "How Covert Agents Infiltrate the Internet to Manipulate, Deceive, and Destroy Reputations." Now, you know,
lovely stuff, isn't it?
It sounds horrific. It's basically like character assassination.
It's exactly what it is, and you do see it once you spot strange forum behavior or comment posting, you become quite sensitive to it, where, you know, people are posting the same things over and over again. It's almost like they have a script or something, or that they may not be employed by, you know, a security services company. It may be part of a lobby group. They may even be volunteers. But there's a lot of misinformation out there, and it's personally why I try and stay away from the public forums, because you could be wasting hours, days, you could waste your life arguing with people who aren't even real people. They're out there to just confuse everybody and waste your time.
Well, I suppose the fact of the matter is those sorts of people are likely to be targeting specific areas on the internet where they want to control the discourse. In other words, where possibly what you're saying is actually right on the money, where there's some need to control the way people are thinking about something.
Yeah, truth is dangerous, especially to certain vested interests who make money off the back of keeping the truth away from people on the internet. Is dangerous in that case.
Well, it's brand. I suppose it's brands, safeguarding brands, trying to safeguard the reputation of that brand.
Yeah, absolutely. You have corporations that have been around for centuries, and they're very, very sensitive to their PR image, particularly if they're painting a picture through marketing campaigns of these holier-than-thou, saintly, lovely, cuddly corporations. And in reality, they're exploiting people and stealing resources all around the world. They don't want people to know that.
Now, just looking at this article, it's on the firstlook.org. That's first, as in F-I-R-S-T, look.org website. A little section of their website they call The Intercept, written by Glenn Greenwald. And it talks about, this is GCHQ in Cheltenham and the National Security Agency, NSA, talking about psychology, a new kind of SIG dev, establishing the Human Science Operations Cell. And they talk about something called JTRIG, which is supposed to be the centre for this with GCHQ and the NSA. They say things like how to discredit a target, set up a honey trap, they say. Now, this is an old-fashioned ruse of sending an attractive lady in, and this of course can just happen on the internet, maybe just a picture of someone from a book or from a magazine pretending to be somebody. They say change their photos on social networking sites, which does kind of assume that they can hack into those social networking sites without very much trouble. Write a blog purporting to be one of their victims, an email or text their colleagues, neighbours, friends, etc. Now, all this seems to me to be kind of a form of hacking. Now, that surely is illegal.
Yeah, I don't think that's too controversial a statement. I think what's funny is that perhaps in the past it was much more difficult to do this. You might have to get someone in a particular setting. It's a bit cliched, a bit James Bond, but you get someone in a hotel, and you have your femme fatale, and you extract information or you photograph them to bribe them. These days, all you need is a webcam, it seems, and everyone's got webcams. And what I find fascinating is that it doesn't seem possible to buy a laptop without a webcam. And I don't know that many people use them on a daily basis. I've been aware for a long time that access to my webcam was, could have been a problem. So I personally cover my one. It's always covered, just because I don't like the idea of being sat there doing whatever I'm doing and someone may be watching me.
Well, I was chatting to one of the presenters on Talk Radio Europe, which is a station down from mostly for expats in Spain and in Southern Europe, the other day, and she pointed out that GCHQ actually looks like a giant webcam pointing up into the sky, that sort of circular donut thing with like an eye in the middle kind of thing. So, yes, I mean, just some very basic ideas. I mean, you're talking about covering it. I know one of the things that I've seen as well, people who are switched onto this kind of thing is just, chop off a little bit of a fabric sticky plaster and stick that over your webcam.
That's exactly what I have. I mean, it's literally, like a bit of a post-it with a kink in it. So I can just pull it back if I do ever need to use it, which, as I said, I don't, I'm not a prolific FaceTime user or Skype user for video calls.
Okay, back to this article, First Look by Glenn Greenwald. One of the other things he talks about is identifying and exploiting fracture points, things that push a group together and things that pull a group apart. Things like basically what they're trying to do is insert fissures into organizations between people. If they think that two or three people are working well together as part of an organization, they want to try and find something to come between them. For example, competition, ideological differences, they say, personal power, pre-existing cleavages between people. So they're trying to, in a way, get a kind of crowbar in between people in any kind of effective activist group.
Yeah, they have categorized them, haven't they? You have your everyday Joe on the street, you have your armchair activist, and you have your actual in the street activists, and they're always trying to frighten people back into the armchair or back into onto the high street to go shopping. And if they do see people with real tenacity, then they're afraid. And they will certainly try and stir things up and break that group apart.
They're also saying, and this is one of the other slight, I mean, this is the amazing thing about the Snowden revelations, is that they're mostly slides from presentations which have been at GCHQ, like a kind of PowerPoint
they're
style
beautiful
thing.
Beautiful slideware, aren't they? They're very nicely put together with all kinds of hideous logos.
This, on this particular one, Gambits for Deception, they call it, create cognitive stress and physiological stress, create stress and exploit the shared effects. So they're actually trying to get into these two individuals and to get them to be afraid, I suppose, to frightened and actually get their heart beating about something and think, oh, crikey, you know, this isn't for me. So the idea is to actually get under their skin.
Yeah, and just put people off activism in general, which sadly is quite easy.
Well, this is worrying because, hang on a minute, these people that they're targeting haven't necessarily done anything wrong at all. It's not as if our money that we pay in tax is going to stopping a foreign enemy. It's actually going to stop political activism, quite legitimate, especially under any kind of system which would allow a security service to get overpowerful. You know, there may be activists who are actually against the security services, trying to be active against them, and then they're not being allowed to. Yeah, and this is taxpayers' money being spent on perfectly legitimate groups who are just simply trying to self-organise.
Well, maybe, but there's another way of looking at it, that anyone who threatens corporate profits in any which way, and anyone who threatens the collection of Western corporations and governments who are doing business around the world in a certain way is trouble, and they just want to make sure that they carry on as they are, and the security services collaborate in that effect to maintain this sort of neo-colonialism.
One of the outcomes of all the Snowden revelations has been much more people are much more aware that they might want to have a private conversation with somebody else. And I know just before the show, you mentioned these Boeing black phones. What are Boeing up to?
Boeing are doing something almost laudable and then swerving it at the last minute. So they're putting together smartphones that guarantee privacy. So I believe BlackBerry's enterprise emails service offers security, and that's why they're the favourite of government.
Hang on, don't officials. Mention BlackBerry's to me, because I've been speaking to some city councillors today from Bristol here who were given BlackBerry's as part of their role that haven't been working. So those BlackBerry numbers are advertised as the contact details for these particular councillors, and the councillors are saying, well, actually, nobody can get through to me. Well, so people have been trying to get through to them on the council BlackBerries and finding basically just a number unobtainable, or they leave a voicemail, which then the councillor can never get.
Well, BlackBerry's in all kinds of trouble, and they have been sort of thrown a lifeline, I believe, by the American authorities. But Boeing seems to have taken up the mantle of security, smartphone security firm du jour, and they're offers secret voice calls. So you're doing, I guess, on the fly, voice call encryption, which I believe is what Silent Circle are offering. And furthermore, these phones are designed so you can't dismantle them, and if you do, which is considered tampering, then it wipes itself. So it does sound, it's quite James Bond in a way, and I believe somebody.
But you know what I'm so cynical about is that the NSA and GCHQ can hack most of these on the way. Your phone might look bigger than normal, it might look blacker than normal, it might wipe itself when you pull it apart, but that doesn't necessarily mean that the communications you're going to have with it are private. It may be that there's some kind of backdoor into the system. I'm cynical. I look at this and I think, well, you know, the mobile phone company is thinking, well, we can add a zero to the price and we can market this as a safe phone.
Well, maybe in the case of the commercial offerings, but with Boeing, they are really trying to offer something so that the American administration can continue what they do and not get rumbled. So I think that's going to be legitimate. And the way that the voice call encryption works is it's using voice over IP. So it's just encrypting voice data packet, so that is possible end-to-end, phone-to-phone. You really can do that. That does work, and with messages, it's the same system. I personally like the sound of this.
Just a minute. During World War II, the Nazis were communicating with each other on the Enigma system. They were convinced that no one could read it, but they could.
I understand what you're saying. I understand what you're saying. But when Boeing and the U.S. you know, government are collaborating / conspiring together, I trust that that's going to be a strong offering. Less so for maybe Google's offering to me. You know, they love the fact that they can listen to us, and they hate the fact that we can never listen to them.
Okay, Ed Lander, thanks very much.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
Now I'm joined by Paul Saville, and Jason Yannikopoulos is in the studio too. Paul Saville is a community artist, quite often to be seen riding his bike around Stokes Croft area. Paul, lovely to have you on eventually, and maybe we can get you back to do reports in the future too. But anyway, just give us an introduction really by explaining, you know, what brought you to become an activist. Why?
Hi Tony, anyway. How are you?
All right, yeah.
Cool. So in 2007, I moved to Bristol.
From?
From Bournemouth, which is where my mum lives, and came to study sociology and criminology. And as you know, Bristol's an active place, creative and passionate and everything else. And
did you say criminology?
Criminology, yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah.
So you were studying sociology and criminology. Tell us about both those subjects.
Sociology I enjoyed more so than criminology. I found it a bit more abstract. Criminology I found a little bit boxy. I don't know how to
describe
just,
what,
it.
Well, just what is sociology about? I mean, a lot of people have probably never come across sociology. It's one of those things they think goes on at universities, yeah. And probably is a waste of money and time.
Okay, so ology is the study of, and socio would be society.
So what are you, when you're actually doing the course, what are you going through? What kind of things are you studying? Society, how it all works, power, that sort of thing?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very broad thing, really. I mean, there's a lot of philosophy locked into it, but also social policy, health, everything from everything within me, but also outwards, you know, just how society works.
Was there anything that really opened your eyes on doing the course about the way society works?
Yeah, I mean, I was just speaking to my friend Jason a minute ago about kind of university as a microcosm of wider society, and how you know, you've got your radio station there, and you've got your shop, and even got your own student representatives who are there to represent your views, and you know, the laundrette and the student village which you can live on, and all of these sorts of things. So, you know, it was very, yeah. But then being living in Bristol for me was a huge influence, and being involved in local politics, but also campaigning and activism from a grassroots level really opened my eyes.
You're talking about politics, but not from a party political point of view. How does that work?
Well, this is the other interesting thing, isn't it? Because, I mean, Russell Brand got a lot of stick, didn't he, about, he said, well, you don't vote. You know, how can you say that you're involved? Lots of people actually are involved very, very deeply in politics in Bristol, but in more in a general sense, you know, but don't necessarily vote.
But unless you can get somebody into a political party, into Westminster, Downing Street, whatever, you can't really change things. It's all talk, surely.
I disagree. Yeah, I think, like, it depends on what you mean by change, really. I think, like, everyone has the tools for change. It depends on how you want to do it. Lots of people until recently lived in squats, and you know, felt like they were doing a lot of change in their society on a grassroots level. But you know, I think for me it is about organizing locally, and it blossoms from there, really, you know.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, it's down to one person's action can make a whole world of change. So I totally agree with what Paul is saying there.
But hang on a minute, Jason, because it's all very well, you can be squatting, but I mean, that's only changing things for you. It's not changing anything, surely, in the wider society.
Do you want to say anything on that one, Paul?
Well, I think that the butterfly effect comes to mind, Tony. You know, this people have influenced me along my journey. And it might be only a little conversation or a meeting with a guy on a radio station or someone at a bus stop, and that can, you know, change people's perspectives.
Well, you know what I'm thinking?
You know,
I'm almost, in a way, I'm going to answer my own question here, because if you have a conversation with someone about squatting, and that other person then at some later point in their life is in a situation where they're homeless, all of a sudden then there's something else which is an option for them. They don't have to, sure, you know, be that afraid, so afraid, yeah, of having no roof over their head.
Yeah.
On the subject of politics, then, what do you make of our mayor here, George Ferguson?
I think you know that already, don't you?
duly elected. I think you had a bit of a scrap with him in the past, but I mean, what's the problem? If you have a problem with George, why?
It's not for me. It's not like George Ferguson as a person so much. It's, I think, more so it's like this situation we have in Bristol where a lot of power has been concentrated into one or a group of people.
Well, even the Evening Post suggested he might be a dictator for a few years.
Well, I found out firsthand when, you know, I was told, when I basically kind of started off where I asked George about residents parking zones and stuff like that, and I didn't really know much about it at the time, but people had said to me, "Oh, do you know this is happening?" And I thought, well, is it just happening and that's it and no one gets a say? So when I bumped into George at the Bear Pit, you know, I asked him about these things and he just kind of said, you know, that's it, I don't want to talk to you, not now, not ever. Even went as far as saying, you're stalking me and this sort of stuff, and you know, wouldn't speak about it. And so, and from then on in, really, it's been like really difficult to get any of the councillors, Ashley Ward councillors or George himself, to really talk about residents parking zones.
Well, they do talk about it. I mean, they've had consultations about it. Mm. It's something that, it does appear, is going to happen. But I mean, they've been elected to do that, surely, Paul.
Yeah, they say that they've consulted people, but I don't really feel like they've consulted my local neighbourhood. And there's a lot of censorship going on online, on the Facebook pages, which is supposedly a place for discussion. And it's just really sad that, because everyone knows what I think, everyone knows what George thinks, but a lot of people in St. Paul's, for example, just haven't been asked. They haven't been asked. That doesn't matter what they think. They don't even know about it, perhaps. Well, and that's really important.
The thing is, I mean, something's got to be done about the parking situation. There are whole areas of the city where if you come back after a certain time, maybe 8 o'clock in the evening, you cannot park anywhere. Mm. So there needs to be something done. And also, St. Paul's particularly is being used as a car park, isn't it? For people that work in the city centre coming into St. Paul's during the day and parking.
And that's it. And maybe you've hit the nail on the head. Commuters perhaps coming into St. Paul's and parking, not residents coming, because that's where they live. And this is it. This doesn't really solve the issues. The issues are that we need to, you know, cut carbon emissions and everything else, and there are perhaps too many cars in St. Paul's. But if you just say, right, you need to pay £40 and that will get you a residence parking permit but won't guarantee you a space, it's not actually going to solve the amount of cars that are in Bristol. There will still be physically around. Where will these cars go? For me, it's about actually having like practical solutions, like reducing fares on First Bus, which are extortionate park and ride schemes and stuff like that, and really addressing the problems rather than just kind of putting a plaster over the wound and essentially making a lot of money from local residents.
But you can't do that. In fact, even George can't decrease the fares on First Bus. It's a private company.
Mm. Yeah, well, you know, that's the situation we're in, aren't we? So,
Jason.
Well, I'm going to come in on that one and say George Ferguson can't physically do that, but he can certainly suggest it, maybe put pressure. Cause
well, one of the other things that he hasn't suggested, in a way, Ferguson has been interesting for the things he hasn't said as much as everything else. For example, he hasn't blamed the City of London for the cuts that Bristol's having to go through, for example. He hasn't, because, of course, he was, for many years, a member of the Society of Merchant Venturers, who have this horrific inheritance of the millions of dead Africans shipped across the Atlantic. He certainly hasn't. I mean, now that organisation has become really basically investment bankers. They've got a fantastic amount of money invested in various hedge funds, various places around the globe.
Yeah, I'm on the topic of merchant ventures and stuff. I became quite interested in that kind of whole thing back when I was at UWE, because I was interested to. But I became very active in UWE society and trying to understand how my university was working and stuff like that, and how, you know, the vice chancellor was being paid lots and lots of money whilst lecturers seemed really stressed out. And during that time, so I can't remember who, but someone mentioned to me about the Merchant Ventures Navigation School, which back in the day was before Bristol Polytechnic, before UWE became UWE, way before was set up. So then now I started to look into the merchant venturers and try and understand who these interesting names were, and I remember coming across a venue, I think a venue investigation by a journalist.
Oh, maybe Rich Cookson, who he used to be the editor of the South West Big Issue based here in Bristol.
Right, okay.
He's now doing stuff. I mean, he was working on, I think, a Channel 4 Dispatches programme about the Somerset floods.
Right,
so he's
okay.
gotten into TV now.
Right.
But Rich's investigation in the Venue magazine was one of the first proper looks at the Merchant Venturers today. Now, George has said he's... you know, nothing more to do with the Merchant Venturers because he's now mayor and it's a conflict of interest. But, of course, the problem is that as the mayor, he's invited to the big do's that the Merchant Venturers put on because, of course, they can't do them without inviting the mayor. So in a way, he's still part of that circle.
Mm. Well, it's like, you know, friends are friends, aren't they? You don't just lose contacts and friends and, you know, it's all right on paper saying that we, you know, we don't speak anymore. And this is the thing, like I said, going back to the original point, was it's not... for me, like, it's not like one person that is causing all of these issues. Actually, it's a whole system of kind of manipulation going on in Bristol and further afield, really. I always felt like the Merchant Venturers stuff was kind of, again, like a microcosm of wider society, perhaps global politics of how, you know, things happen globally. And... yeah, I mean, for me, going back to the residence parking zone as well, like, it's about people being listened to, essentially. And actually, George, you know, said to people that when he was being elected that he wanted to, what's the word, you know, give power back to local communities to make their own decisions. And that just simply hasn't happened on the residence parking zone anyway.
Well, getting back to you, Paul, you're an artist. What sort of artwork do you do?
Anything, really. I've done all sorts. Sculpture, mosaic, stencil, spray can, done commissions. A friend and I did a piece for the Olympics a couple of years ago. Oh, anti-Olympics, not for the Olympics.
Anti-Olympics? Yeah. Why? What's wrong with the Olympics?
Oh, no, I've got no problem with the Olympics. It's just all the money invested and all the McDonald's, I'm loving it, and all that sort of thing. And,
well, there were some quite dodgy sponsors, weren't there, of the London Olympics?
Well, Atos, weren't they?
Atos are sponsors of the Paralympics, which was absolutely horrific as far as I was concerned, you know.
I think there were some of the participants in the Paralympics who even turned their shirts around and things like that, put things across their shirts so that the Atos sponsorship symbol couldn't be seen by cameras and that kind of thing.
This is what I'm saying, Tony, is that the changes that we're talking about, you know, how can you have a little change? Simply as that, simply as wearing your T-shirt inside out, that can have a massive impact. If I walk through Broadmead tomorrow doing that with, do you know what Atos is? Do you give Atos or something like that? Then people will start to go, oh, yeah, what is that Atos place, you know?
Okay. Stokescroft, People's Republic of Stokescroft, is a sort of, it's an organisation which is just up on Jamaica Street, but it's also a bit of an ethos, isn't it? What is it you think that makes Stokescroft a bit different in the city?
When I moved to Bristol back in 2007, Stokescroft was a really interesting place. The canteen hadn't opened then, which I think is one of George's
yeah,
places.
It's in a way, I mean, a lot of people will say it's a kind of marvellous bit of public relations for him.
Yeah, that's it. Stokescroft, with the free shop and, what was it? There was the anarchist bookshop, even going back, it's Telepathic Heights, the Jester's place, which then turned into the Tesco's, numerous squats, a really diverse music scene, which is still in operation, Lakota, all of these places really, even the bear pits of a certain extent before it turned into the bear pit, you know, really offered me something like this different way of like seeing things, like property ownership and just seeing like how like beauty can be really destruction can be turned into beauty and vice versa, you know, and people can really build stuff if they want to.
Well, you mentioned the free shop there. That's not no longer there.
Apparently
it's opening again very soon in the city centre
at
the Ark Bar on Broad Street again, thank goodness, with lots of free... It's like a charity shop for free. But then it was a derelict building. It had been derelict for something like 20 years, owned by some dodgy company in Hong Kong.
Yeah.
It was a place where actually... official bodies in the council were referring people there, saying, yeah, you know, sure, if you need clothes for your baby, we're afraid that the government isn't going to give you any money, but you may be able to get some free clothes at the free shop.
Amazing, huh? Amazing. I just, yeah, that those type of places were the places that really made Stokes go. For me, it's gone a little bit too. I don't know.
What do you think of the new Bear Pit then, with the trading stalls and things like that down there?
I'm personally, it's not my business. I don't really like how it's going.
They've got a container, haven't they? I've noticed that containers and things like that down there.
The ideas are fantastic. I just think, like, when money starts to, for me, grassroots activism is always, you don't need any money, right? Well, money can help, but you don't need a lot of money to do anything. You can really start to design change in your community by just doing simple things.
So are you against the idea of people wanting to better themselves by getting big incomes and that kind of thing?
I'm not against anyone really. I'm interested by what I'm absorbing around me all the time, you know, and I respect people to live the life they want to live, actually. And
are you saying that maybe you can live on almost nothing if you got the imagination to do so?
I have done for a number of years, and and I find that actually that's the times when things are most creative. When I found that when a lot of money is injected in, suddenly these fantastic projects are jumped upon by people who maybe necessarily don't have the expertise or don't have the passion to do it because their heart tells them to. They were doing it to get a bit of money or to get carve a project out, you know.
It's funny, isn't it? Because money can be a value, you know. Everyone's got values of, you know, right and wrong,
sure,
something that's important to them, something that's not. Money's a sort of shortcut, isn't it, to say, well, am I going to get money out of it or not? That's another way of thinking, and it's a shortcut to actually doing that thought about, do I really want to do this or not? So you say you managed without money for a while. I mean,
well, I've been homeless a couple of times, and that really opened my eyes up to a few things, like happiness and freedom. And
well, most people would say homeless would be not happiness and freedom; it would be a nightmare.
Oh, it was a nightmare, absolutely. Not having these ties to my iPhone or to even to a home, like I was living in a tent at the time, but, you know, even not having to pay rent, to having to go to a job, you know, that didn't really inspire me that much, but just having the bare essentials to live on really, really opened my... That was when I was 16 and 17, when I was homeless. And you're absolutely right. It was a nightmare. I'm not going to, you know, make it sound really glamorous.
So how did you manage to turn it into something you're now saying was actually quite positive?
Well, I... strong believer in that all life's experiences make us into the people we are, and everything that's happened to me previous has made me into the person I am now, and through those sorts of situations that I've lived through, it's made me into a person who, yeah, I am compassionate, I do care about people, and bedroom tax, and, you know, the ATOS stuff that's coming out at the moment, and, well, just everything that's going on at the moment makes me angry, it makes me want to do something about it, you know.
Well, Paul, fascinating chatting with you, and I hope you may be able to come back in the future in a few months' time,
sure,
and just maybe bring us up to date with how things are going. Sure. In the meantime, Jason, we're going to go through some of this week's news, and do feel free, Paul, to chip in if you want to, and start this week with the number 10 advisor, that is Patrick Rock, we're hearing this week. He is a senior Tory advisor, and he's been arrested on child abuse images allegations. This is pretty shocking stuff.
Well, yeah, it's very tough stuff. We have somebody in number 10 working for the Prime Minister, a government which has done a large drive on things like Operation U-Tree, where they're just arresting a lot of people for child abuse. And he's just been arrested for looking at images of child abuse. So, you know.
Allegedly.
Allegedly.
Yeah, so we'll find out in the court case whether he's actually guilty of it. But obviously, I mean, the police will have some sort of evidence in order to have gone to do that. He's not the first person at Downing Street to be questioned by the police on trial. That's right. The Prime Minister's press secretary, Andy Coulson,
is on trial as
is
we
on,
speak.
On trial right now. And has also been charged with perjury as well in the Tommy Sheridan trial up in the Scottish Socialist leader up in Scotland. So I mean, it does seem like things aren't looking too good for David Cameron, if we can talk about him rather than the various people that seem to have been.
Well, he does seem to be surrounding himself with an interesting bunch of people.
And maybe it's questioning, I think, you know, questioning his judgment around employing, having these sort of people. Also, his Mr. Powell, who's his number two national security advisor, walking into Downing Street the other day with all the secret plans for Ukraine very, very visible for everyone to see and being photographed. I mean, this is the about fourth or fifth time this has happened. You'd have thought that someone who's advising on national security would not be the person to make the big mistake of walking in to Downing Street with all these secret documents on display to the press and public.
Well, I think we just got to be very glad that it wasn't like a nuclear launch code or something, you know.
Yes, Jason, yes, I totally agree with you there. Okay, next story is the student loans chair. Who's this, the chairman of the student loans company?
Well, this is a very interesting one. David Willetts has claimed he's delighted at the fact that they've appointed senior UBS banker Chris Brody to be the chair of the Students Loans Company, citing that Brody has a wealth of experience. Now, from 2001 to 2013, he was a board member of UBS Investment Bank at the time when the scandal hit investment branch he was chair of, and by the time he retired, he's one of its two vice chairmen. It was traders from UBS Investment Bank who in 2012 brought a fine of £940 million on the bank for manipulating LIBOR rates.
Has he himself been prosecuted for this, or is it his bank that's been fined and the bank has been told to press a little button and make up a few million pounds to pay a fine in one of their computer screens?
Well, he was on the board, so he was certainly overseeing this while it was happening.
So he went into the room and said, press that button on that computer account with a few extra zeros on that account and we'll pay the fine like that.
It doesn't quite say that.
Get a printer in here.
Oh, but that's counterfeiting, Paul. We couldn't have any of that. Let's make up some money.
When I was growing up, my mum used to watch Comic Relief and stuff. And as a genuine question, I'd ask my mum, I'd say, why can't we just print loads of money and send it to Africa? And my mum said, don't ask stupid questions. But it was this genuine question, is why can't we just make loads of money and send it to people who need money?
It's actually quite the right question to ask, because it would be perfectly doable. It's just that the way that the money system works in this country is debt-based money. If you make some money, it is also commensurate with a debt that you have to then pay it back. Now, the way that interest works, of course, it's constantly creaming a little bit off of that. And so it means there's never enough money to pay off the debt. Never enough money to pay off the interest at home. If you look at the wider problem in Ukraine, for example, that's all been over money. It's about whether the Ukraine parliament is going to be borrowing money from Russia or borrowing money from the EU, one way or the other. Anyway, getting off the subject a little bit there, but Jason, back to you. And you've got, I think, something nice to say for a change about the Daily Mail. Is that right?
Not exactly. Well, actually, it's more amusing. This was Daily Mail reporter Andrew Pearce was unleashed to basically do a really nasty piece on environmental agency boss Chris Smith. He swiftly bashed out a 900-word document in which he was sort of pretty much accused Chris Smith of just about everything under the sun. Only for editor Paul Dacre, to spike the piece, because as it turns out, Lord Smith has just been appointed chair of the Independent Press Standards Organisation.
Well, it'd be nice to read that article. Such a shame it's not going to be in the Daily Mail. Mind you, Chris Smith isn't the most favourite person around the Somerset levels right now, is he? And I think they probably would do quite well to increase their circulation down there. Okay, next story, Crossrail. Now, this is in London, I think, isn't it? It's some sort of railway system which is being used to leak.
London railway system, and actually it's something even more for me, because one of the two terminuses for Crossrail Line 1 is Maidenhead. So it's interesting. The government decision to hand £1 billion Crossrail investment to foreign contractor Bombardier, which is a Canadian manufacturer, and Tory MP Patrick McLaughlin has said it's great for British manufacturing the fact they chose Bombardier.
Yeah, they aren't that. Don't they own some sort of British railway train manufacturing?
Well, they do have an assembly factory in Derby, but we consider that in the British Rail era, Derby was one of the world's foremost rail research centres that turned some really good concepts into some really good products. And computerised signalling, for instance, developed there in the 70s and 80s. It points out in this article that when Railtrack took over, they were doing some great stuff on signalling. And this was done in Britain. So Trackshaw, which is a group that introduces stock components on tracks, which are being used by Dutch, German, Italian and American railways. They're one of these companies that have just been produced this. They've been bought by London Underground without actually being checked whether or not they work. The point it makes in the article is the fact that it's handing it over to foreign groups, despite the fact that there are still some decent British groups like Delta Rail, which is an independent British firm, who are actually already got some decent research on stuff that Crossrail will need.
But maybe they can get it cheaper abroad.
Well, don't say that. I mean, they're already throwing cash at it. I mean, was it what, £1 billion doesn't sound to me to be particularly cheap?
No, it doesn't, does it? Okay, final story about arms dealing. Is this an arms dealer or just general arms dealing, Jason?
Well, it's interesting. It's what do former Tory defence ministers do to keep busy? If it happens, they help arms deals in the Middle East. That's literally what it says.
So who is up to what now then? Arms deals in the Middle East by former...
According to the latest MPs, Register of MPs' Interest, Gerald Howarth, who's one of the Tory defence ministers, he took cash from the Bahraini government to attend last month's Bahrain air show, a key marketplace for international arms trades, they were exhibiting things such as drones and ground attack aircraft.
Maybe he's just a keen former Tory defence plane spotter. No?
Howarth said he was invited by the Bahrainis and his trip was paid for them by Farnborough. And by Farnborough International, an airshow specialist, helped organise that event. Now, the UK government sent its own official delegation to the same event, and Defence Secretary Philip Hammond took with him civil servants specialising in arms trade promotion, along with executives from defence firms, including BAE Systems.
Oh no, not them again. These are the ones that sold off Filton Airfield, aren't they, for housing that there's no infrastructure or roads for. Anyway, Jason, thanks very much, and Paul Saville too, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Teddy.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk. UK.
And now Sarah Bromberg is joining Jason Yannikopoulos and I. Sarah, we're going to have a little bit of a chat about Atos, this notorious company, but what were they actually doing?
They were running healthcare checks on claimants for disability living allowance benefits and employment support allowance benefits.
Okay.
For over 6 months.
For disability living allowance, what is that?
It's for people who have a mental health illness, a physical injury, who are unable to get work and who need the money in order to survive.
And what about employment support allowance?
Employment support allowance is an extra benefit that you get in order to help to support to look for work. And if you're in one of two categories, you are forced to go on interviews and work-related courses and healthcare checks. If you're not, then you're basically ignored.
Oh, well, that's a shame. And what about the market? Is it really a reasonable market? Is there a reasonable chance of someone who is on DLA getting a job nowadays?
In my opinion, no. There's hardly any jobs out there for people who are struggling. the DLA is probably actually less than what you get if what you're earning in a job. I myself am on different bandings, lower and middle care. There are several different bandings within disability living allowance. Depending on what you get is depending on your level of current support need. There are three different bandings, which are higher care, lower care, and middle care, and lower mobility, middle mobility, and higher mobility. And depending on your ESA banding, will vary greatly on what you get for your ESA, for your DLA banding.
Now, I also understand that some of this money can go towards paying people to help you. I mean, someone, for example, to come to your home, assist in various things. Is that right?
In some cases, yeah. The Employment Support Allowance can help with finding work, getting an interview suit and going on work courses. But obviously, some people are known as benefits cheats, so have been abusing the system. And this is what the government have been trying to clamp down on.
Okay, Jason, now ATOS as an organisation, there have been leaks apparently that the workers' capability assessments that ATOS have been doing are being scrapped because they're ducking out of the contract and they don't want to do them anymore.
Rather than the assessments being scrapped, ATOS are trying to quit the contract. They're trying to end their involvement in it. They feel that their staff have been threatened. They feel that there's sufficient danger to their staff. As it happens, the assessments themselves aren't being scrapped. It's been nicely put up for auction between three companies, and those three companies are G4S, Serco, A4E, and Capita.
Oh, crikey. And these are all these big outsourcing companies. They're basically taking over the jobs that the civil service used to do, and also far, far less accountable. We also know about the fiasco with G4S and the London Olympics, that they don't actually necessarily do what they say.
It's interesting because Capita already do two zones worth of disability benefit testing. They cover the Midlands and Northern Ireland, whereas ATOS do the rest. So this could be a thing. Also, rather more interesting, ATOS have just won a contract to deal with NHS data, the whole NHS data program.
This is the private patient records.
Yeah.
So ATOS are going to be dealing with those.
Yeah.
That is frightening, actually. Actually quite frightening to think that these people are going to be having our hands on our personal private data, medical records. It's an IT firm, I think, isn't it? Why are they doing these sort of medical assessments, for goodness sake?
Well, that's a very good question, one I don't actually have an answer to.
Okay, well, I've flummoxed you finally there, Jason. Sarah Bromberg and Jason Yannakopoulos, thanks for enlightening us about the intrigues of ATOS.
Thanks.
Thank you, Tony.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
Jeff Sparks with our local What's On Guide.
Thank you, Tony. Hello, this is your What's On Guide from Dialect. Starting with Friday 7th of March, the Vibrators will be performing with support from Viva La Punk and also The Blush at the Thunderbolt in Bath Road, Bristol. Tickets are £6 in advance and doors open at 7:30 p.m. On to Song of the Week, and I present Steve Vai. He hails from Long Island, New York, and is a guitarist, songwriter and producer who, in a career that started in 1983, has released 8 studio albums, 2 EPs, 8 live albums and numerous other releases. This song features his 2-year-old son Julian on vocals and is titled Yeah Yo Gak and is from the EP Alien Love Secrets.
Yeah!
was Steve Vai with Yayo Gak from the EP Alien Love Secrets.
Just a moment, Jeff, I just have to ask you about that particular song. It sounded like some sort of two-year-old German baby being sick.
Not exactly. For more information on Steve Vai, check out www.vai.com, that is VAI.com. And to Saturday, 8th of March, the Mods will be performing at the Tunnels in Bristol and Exeter Mews, Bristol. Tickets are £10 each and doors open at 7:30pm. Finally, on Monday, 10th of March, Fearless Vampire Killers will be performing with support from Ashes to Angels at the Exchange in Old Market, Bristol. Tickets are £8 in advance and doors open at 7:30pm. That is all from me. Thanks for listening and have a good week. Take care and goodbye.
Thanks, Jeff. That's all for this week. Dialect's a weekly podcast for your MP3 player, produced by volunteers and broadcast on Bristol Community FM 93.2 at 11am every Thursday morning. If you're online, you can subscribe to our RSS feed or email list, which will remind you every Tuesday evening when Dialect goes online. You can do that or download this weekly podcast from dialectradio.co.uk, as well as the BCFM website at bcfmradio.com. Thanks to our studio guests this week and also to studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Dialect's a Bristol Broadband Co-op production and anyone can contribute. If you'd like to, contact us through Volunteering Bristol 0117 989 7733 and they're on the web at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. That was Dialect and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening, so until the same time next week, goodbye for now.
Celebrate all and all, there's something to give.